Freaks and Tomb Dwellers, and welcome back to the Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we kick off this episode, I just wanted to bring up a couple things. Number one, I have now made it into the second round of the Next Up contest. There's 5 days left in this round until the top 10 move to round 3. I just wanted to thank every single one of you who has voted for me. I really appreciate it, and I never even expected to make it this far into this contest. So that's really something for me, and I really mean it. I thank all of you who have voted for me. Second thing is that me and Jerry are finally going to be releasing the first single from our Starship Poopers side project. It's been a long time coming and been delayed quite a few times, but I finally got Jerry's vocals, and I did mine as well, and I will be putting them to the musical track that I recorded, and we will be releasing that in the second week of July. So keep an eye out for that. I'll be releasing it under my own band's name, Raped by Wolves, just because I'm lazy and haven't set up a Spotify page yet for Starship Poopers. But eventually there will be a Spotify page for Starship Poopers, just not right now because, once again, I'm too lazy. But I will have that done before we do release the full album. And I do have a couple listener emails that I'm going to read at the top of this episode, so let's get into those. This one is from carlifeislove@gmail.com, and they ask, "Hey, love your show. I just had one quick question. Whatever happened to your part-time co-host, Animus Morg? I haven't heard him on an episode lately, and I was just wondering if you guys had a fallout or not." No, things between me and Jerry are fine. Summer is just a really hard time to get a hold of him, because he's usually helping out with some kind of fucking Mormon camp bullshit that his aunt and uncle run. So, like I said, it's kind of really hard to get a hold of him because he's, like, never around during the summer. But hopefully I will be having him on for another episode soon. And things between me and him are fine. Like I said, he's just a hard guy to get a hold of during the summer. Because you'd have to ask him. But he works with his aunt and uncle at some kind of Mormon camp, like I said, that they run. It's kind of a weird situation, I guess. But I'll be sure to ask him about it next time that I have him on. And this other one that I'm going to read is from southernpridegirl@gmail.com. And she writes, "Hey, long-time listener, first-time writer. I have noticed that every now and then you will do a musical episode, and I was wondering why you do this since you are a horror movie podcast. And also, I was wondering if you are a fan of nu metal and what you think of the recent nu metal resurgence." As I explained, this podcast originally started out as a music podcast, but then after like 3 or 4 episodes, I can't really remember which, I decided to switch formats because if you look through, you know, like your podcast episodes on Spotify or whatever wherever you listen to them, your podcasts too, there are a lot of music podcasts out there. And I felt that there was just way too much competition Not that there aren't a lot of movie podcasts out there, but I just kind of figured that I'd kind of have a little more of a chance talking about movies than I would about music, even though I am a music guy, obviously. And as far as the nu metal thing goes, I'm really going to date myself and make myself seem old. But, I mean, I was around when the first, when nu metal was actually a thing. The first and second and third waves of it, I mean. And I've always been more into the more heavy, extreme end of metal, such as, like, death metal, deathcore, black metal, metalcore, all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, yeah, I listen to some nu metal, you know. I'm ashamed to admit it, but the Limp Bizkits, that's the fucking first album from Crazy Town. You know, the Korns, the Slipknots, the Taproots, the Coal Chambers, all that kind of stuff. And nu metal has always been kind of a dirty word for metal fans. You may have heard of it referred to derogatorily as Malcore or Angstcore. I mean, it, of course it had its fan and its fans and it had its place. I mean, not all of it was bad. There were some good bands, like I said, you know, like Linkin Park, Stained, Taproot, Korn, a bunch of others. But like most musical genres, you know, eventually every record label was rushing to sign the next big band in that genre. And so, of course, the scene got glutted with a bunch of shit that wasn't worth your time listening to. And that eventually killed the genre. You know, I blame bands like Limp Bizkit, even though I did enjoy, you know, their first album, or their first two albums. And, you know, a lot of the good bands that were out there didn't get their chance to be heard because of this. You know, I mean, at one point, Godsmack was a nu metal band with their first album. But then they evolved into what they are now, for better or worse. And for younger listeners who might be like, the fuck are you talking about? What the fuck is nu metal? Nu metal was basically a reaction to what was going on in the music scene in the mid to late 90s. When it first, or when nu metal first came out as a genre. Back then, metal wasn't in good shape due to grunge basically killing off, you know, all forms of heavy metal. You know, the Nirvanas, the Pearl Jams, the Soundgardens, all of them, they basically killed the heavy metal scene. So, nu metal was basically a reaction to what was going on with the grunge scene. You know, that's when Korn, who basically invented the genre, put out their first album back in 92 or 93, I believe it was. Their self-titled debut album. And, you know, basically it kicked off from there. You know, then the Limp Bizkits and Linkin Parks and the Orgies, who Orgy really wasn't a nu metal band, but they were lumped in with that genre. No, they all started to surface. And then, like I said, it started in the mid-90s, like I said. And then it pretty much carried into the early 2000s. And then it basically died off because of all the shitty bands that were being signed in the rush for record labels to find the next big thing. But in recent years, nu metal has started to pick up steam again. I don't know if it's because of nostalgia or what, but it has had a resurgence in the past few years. Like I said, you know, bands like Kane Hill, Dropout Kings, Tala, and Love 'Em or Hate 'Em, Amur and Attila are basically carrying the torch for nu metal now. It's definitely not the same nu metal that it once was back in the day, But it's nice to see it kind of get kind of a new spin on it. And that, once again, you know, there are shitty bands that are labeled as new metal or new metal these days, but there are some pretty good ones, like I said, like the ones I mentioned. But you kind of have to, what's the best way I'm trying to say this? You have to separate the good from the shit. And like I said, there are some new metal bands that are worth your time listening to. Others, not. But, I mean, I guess to answer your question in a roundabout way, I was kind of a fan of new metal back in the day. You know what, once again, the Korns, the Stains, the Taproots, all those kinds of bands. But to me, for the most part, there was just too much shit in the genre to make it a genre that was worth 100% of my time listening to. New metal was usually pretty identifiable by their by the use of down-tuned 7-string guitars and pretty angsty "I hate my parents" lyrics, which surprises me because that I was more into back when I was a teenager, because that's kind of how I felt like pretty much every teenager. The vocals were usually done in either a screamed, clean sung, or rap kind of style. Sometimes all three, sometimes one of the three, and other times two out of the three. Like Limp Bizkit or Linkin Park or Dry Kill Logic. New metal is pretty much a dirty word, or was at least back in the day, for any metalhead. But now, like I said, with the resurgence, it's kind of starting to regain the respect that it never got earlier, for better or worse. And now that I've got all that out of the way, let's get into the episode proper. I decided to do a part two of the Golden Toilet Bowl Awards, which is basically where I talk shit about horror movies that I don't think are worth your time watching. I did the first part either at the beginning of season 4 or near the end of season 3. I don't know, man. I can't fucking remember. I put so many episodes out in the last year and some change. But if you want to hear that first part, go back and find it for yourself, because like I said, it was either at the beginning of season 4 or near the end of season 3. One of the two, I don't fucking know. But let's get it started with 2020's Brahms' The Boy 2.
Oh my goodness, look at that. That must be the main house. Come on, dude.
Beware his story, one and all. Brahms was never just a doll. To live again, he needs a friend. His deadly rules will never end. If you break them, it's best to pray. For Brahms wants more than just a play.
He's got a secret that only he knows.
Something is happening to him.
Love you, Mommy.
I love you.
Jude?
Brahms, The Boy 2.
Liza and her son Jude survive a home invasion by two masked men, but are left traumatized by the event. Liza is plagued by nightmares while Jude develops mutism and is left communicating through a notepad. Liza's husband, Sean, suggests they relocate to the countryside to recuperate. The family then moves to a manor, unaware of its dark history. Arriving at the manor house, they explore the property and Jude finds a porcelain doll buried in the ground. Liza and Sean explore a nearby mansion, and realizing that Jude is missing, Liza searches for him and finds him in possession of the doll. Encouraged by Jude's connection to it, Liza cleans it off Brahms, making the doll look new. The next day, Liza and Jude take a walk around the property at Jude's request, They meet Joseph, the property caretaker, and his dog. Tensions then begin to build when Sean urges Liza to talk about the events of the burglary, but she just fucking won't. Back in the house, Liza and Sean overhear Jude talking in his room. They ask if he is talking to Brahms, and Jude writes yes on his notepad. Weird events then occur around the house, and Sean and Liza discuss a change in Jude's behavior with their therapist. Joseph then talks to Jude about his dog being missing, but no one appears to have seen the dog. Liza finds disturbing pictures and assumes that they have been drawn by Jude. Later that evening, the family has dinner, and Jude writes on his notepad that Brahms played is missing. Liza, upset about the stuff that happened earlier, says that Brahms does not eat because he's a doll. She and Sean then argue in the kitchen, and Sean leaves the room. She goes to sit with Jude at the table and tells him that he needs to stay at the table until he eats. Jude then writes on his notepad that she is making Brahms mad, and she leaves the dining room and hears a loud noise. She and Sean then run into the room, finding the dining room table and chairs overturned. Jude, scared, wrote that he told Liza not to make Brahms mad, and arguing about Brahms and Jude, Sean and Liza disagree about the mysterious things that are happening. Jude then leaves for the nearby mansion with Brahms in hand, leaving a note that reads, "You should have followed the rules." Joseph finds Sean and Liza in the mansion and tells them briefly about a family that had lived there prior. He says that a boy named Brahms had lived there and he had killed two people and did not leave the mansion for 30 years. Shortly after, Sean's brother and his family come to visit. Will, Jude's cousin, gets mysteriously injured during the visit, and which makes Liza become even more upset. Liza then later hits Joseph in the head, and she begs to know where Jude is. Joseph tells her that it will be over soon, and that Brahms and Jude are gonna be one. Liza then gets loose and goes to look for Jude in the mansion. Sean then finds Liza and Jude in the basement and hits Brahms with a croquet mallet, revealing a demonic rotting area underneath his face. Joseph then starts to get scared and says that it will never be over, and that Brahms will take out the family's failure to follow the rules on him. A furnace then explodes, killing Joseph, but leaving the family unharmed. Jude grabs Brahms and throws him into the fire. Liza, Sean, and Jude are soon back at their home in the city. Everything seems normal. However, when he is left alone in his room, Jude walks over to his dresser and puts on a porcelain mask, and he wishes Brahms a good night and says that everything will be fine if his family follows the rules, and the movie ends. A quote-unquote standalone sequel to 2016's The Boy. The story in this has almost absolutely nothing to do with what was going on in the first film. It's like pretty much everything that happened in that was ignored for this. This has a supernatural element to it, and has, like I said, absolutely nothing to do with the fact that Brahms had been alive in the first film, instead of it just being a doll like it is in this movie. But it is mentioned, like I said earlier, or the events of the first film are mentioned earlier in the film. But I don't really understand why they decided to go with the supernatural bent in this movie, and make it so that Brahms really is an evil doll when nothing like that even happened in the first film. It gets confusing and really doesn't make much sense, especially if you've seen the first film. Someone like Katie Holmes should have known better than to appear in shit like this. But hey, I guess she was just in it for a paycheck. Despite everything I said, this had a budget of $10 million, and despite everything that I've said, it brought in $20.3 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 4.7 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 11%, Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a half out of 5. Next up, we have the fucking god-awful 2008 2009 horror comedy, Jennifer's Body.
Wear something cute, okay?
You always do what Jennifer tells you to do.
It's just that I like the same things that she likes.
Hey, Jennifer. You look really pretty.
Why don't you just come by my place? That was random.
This isn't really your house, is it?
We can play Mommy and Daddy.
No way.
We always share your bed when we have slumber parties.
Jennifer's evil.
I know.
No, I mean, she's actually evil. Not high school evil.
Chip is looking really cute to me lately.
How is he tasting these days?
You are never a good friend.
You could have anybody that you want.
Why Chip?
You're killing people.
No, I'm killing boys.
Are you scared?
You only murder boys.
I go both ways. I will finish you if I have to.
Okay.
You can barely finish gym class.
The movie opens with Anita Lesnicki. Once an insecure and studious teenager living in the small town of Devilskill, Minnesota, now a violent mental inmate who narrates the story as a flashback while in solitary confinement. Since childhood, she has been friends with Jennifer Check, a popular cheerleader despite having little in common. One night, Jennifer takes Needy to a local dive bar to attend a concert by indie rock band Low Shoulder. A fire engulfs the bar, killing several people, and Jennifer leaves with the band. Later that evening, she appears in Needy's kitchen covered in blood and attempting to eat a rotisserie chicken. She immediately vomits a trail of black fluid and almost bites Needy's neck, but retreats and leaves. Next morning at school, Jennifer appears fine and dismisses Needy's concerns, appearing apathetic to the fire tragedy. She then seduces the school's football captain and disembowels him. Meanwhile, Low Shoulder gains popularity due to their falsely rumored heroism during the fire, and offer to make a charity appearance at the school's spring formal. A month later, Jennifer appears sick and listless. She accepts a date with school alternative emo Colin, whom she brutally kills. While Needy and her boyfriend Chip have sex, Needy senses something dreadful has happened. She leaves in a panic and almost runs over Jennifer, who is drenched in blood. Jennifer then visits Needy at home, and the two kiss. Jennifer explains that Low Shoulder had taken her into the woods after the bar fire and offered her as a virgin sacrifice to Satan in exchange for fame and fortune. Although the sacrifice was a success, Jennifer was not actually a virgin, so she became permanently possessed. She then became hungry, and Amit, a foreign exchange student who was thought to have died in the fire, was her first victim. She had intended to eat Needy as well, but left because she could not bring herself to hurt her best friend. When she has eaten, she can withstand virtually any injury without pain and heals instantly. Needy then goes to the school's library occult section and determines that Jennifer is a succubus who must feed on flesh and can only be killed while she is hungry and weak. Needy then tells Chip about Jennifer, and of course he doesn't believe her, so she breaks up with him in order to protect him. Chip is then intercepted by Jennifer on the way to the school dance, and she takes him to an abandoned pool and begins feeding on him. Needy then arrives, and Chip impales Jennifer through the stomach with a pool skimmer, but Jennifer escapes, and Chip dies. Angry and heartbroken, Needy breaks into Jennifer's bedroom. The two fight, and Jennifer bites Needy's neck in the struggle. Needy then rips Jennifer's half of their best friend necklace off her neck, and Jennifer stops fighting back, and Needy stabs her in the heart with a utility knife, killing her and destroying the demon. Jennifer's mother then enters and finds Needy on top of her dead daughter's body, and Needy is brought to an asylum, where she now manifests some of Jennifer's supernatural powers due to the bite. She manages to escape the mental facility and hitchhikes a ride, telling the driver she is following a band. And then in the after credits scene, a home video and crime scene photo and crime scene photos show that the members of Low Shoulder were murdered in their hotel by Needy. This is such a stupid fucking movie. You can feel your brain cells start to die as you watch it. It's that fucking bad. And I don't know, I mean, if they had hired somebody besides Megan Fox to play Jennifer in this, it might have been an okay movie. But since they hired Megan Fox, who pretty much destroys every single fucking movie she's in, this movie just sucks. I mean, I don't know why anybody ever decided that she can act, because she just fucking can't. I guess it's because of her looks or some shit like that. But the bitch sucks at acting. I mean, I can't be any nicer than that. She just fucking sucks. And this movie sucks 98% of the time because she is in it. And, you know, the other 2% is just because this is a stupid story. And just an all-around stupid movie. And everybody involved should have known better than to appear in this. This had a budget of $16 million. And somehow brought in $31.6 million at the box office. IMDb gives us a 5.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes of 45%. Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5. And I give it a 0 out of 5. Next up, we have 2008's just as mind-numbingly fucking dumb, The Happening.
I don't know if any of you guys have heard about this article in the New York Times. Well, apparently, honeybees are just disappearing all over the country. Tens of millions of them. All right, let's hear some theories about why this might be happening. Nobody? You're not interested in what happened to the bees? Excuse all the teachers. The administration makes us teach with a foot of snow on the ground. What is this?
There appears to be an event happening.
Homeland Security and the CDC
has reported attacks. Boston, Philadelphia,
Maryland. White House officials claim the CIA has a defense against chemical weapons.
I don't understand what you say. Everyone's dead outside.
What's going on?
We lost contact.
With who?
Everyone.
The government's testing something there that went wrong.
The affected area now includes California.
Authorities are not feeling by the sheer numbers of attacks that a terrorist group being responsible is becoming less and less likely.
Science will come up with some reason to put in the books. But in the end, it'll be just a theory. We will fail to acknowledge that there are forces at work beyond our understanding.
The movie opens in New York City Central Park, where people have begun committing mass suicide. The event is believed to be caused by a bioterrorist attack using an airborne neurotoxin, and the behavior quickly spreads across the northeastern United States. High school science teacher Elliot Moore and his wife Alma are convinced by Elliot's mathematician colleague Julian to accompany him and his daughter Jess on a train out to Philadelphia. During the trip, the group learns that Boston and Philadelphia have also been affected, and the train loses all radio contact and stops at a small town. When Julian learns that his wife has left Boston for Princeton, he decides to go look for her and entrust Jess to the Moors. However, Julian arrives to find Princeton has been affected, and he commits suicide by slitting his wrist. Elliot, Alma, and Jess then hitch a ride with the nurse with the nurseryman and his wife. The nurseryman theorizes that plant life has developed a defense mechanism against humans consisting of an airborne toxin that stimulates neurotransmitters and causes humans to kill themselves. The group is then later joined by other survivors coming from various directions, and the small crowd chooses to avoid roads and populated areas. When the larger part of the group is affected by the toxin, Elliot suggests the nurseryman was right and that the plants are targeting only large groups of people. He splits their group into smaller pockets and they go along their way. The trio then ends up with a pair of teenage boys, Josh and Jared, who are later shot and killed by the armed residents of a barricaded house. Elliot, Alma, and Jess wander the countryside and come upon the home of Mrs. Jones, an eccentric and paranoid old lady. Jones initially agrees to house the group for the night, but is suspicious of them having bad intentions, and so the next morning she decides to kick them out. In a fury, she leaves the house alone and is affected by the toxin. The shaken Elliot realizes that the plants are now targeting individuals, and left with no other option, when Mrs. Jones strikes her head into several windows, the trio chooses to die and embraces in the yard, only to find themselves unaffected by the toxin. And it turns out that the outbreak has ended just as quickly as it began. 3 months later, Elliot and Alma have adjusted to their new life with Jess as their adopted daughter, and Alma also learns that she is pregnant and surprises Elliot with the news. On television, an expert compares the natural events to a red tide and warns that the epidemic may have only been a harbinger of an impending global disaster. And then in Paris, people once again begin to commit mass suicide as the movie ends. I made it quite clear in past episodes that I am not a fan of M. Night Shyamalan movies, and this is one of them. In my opinion, it's one of the fucking worst he's ever done, next to, The Village, which is another one of his movies I absolutely loathe and despise. The plot is reasonable enough in this. It's just all executed quite badly and confusingly, and killer plants have been done a lot better in other movies, such as The Ruins, and any other movie you can think of that involves killer plants, which aren't very many, to be quite honest. The cast tries their best with a quite stupid plot, like I said. People like Mark Wahlberg, who I do like as an actor, probably should have known better than to get themselves involved with something like this. It's just a stupid movie throughout, and it really doesn't have any redeeming value. And it's actually quite boring and has very long periods where nothing really happens. And it just kind of drags on and on and on. So in my opinion, it's really not worth your time watching. This had a budget of between $48 to $60 million and somehow brought in $163.4 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes of 17%. Letterboxd 3.6 out of 5 for some fucking reason. And I give it a 1 out of 5. And that brings us to 2020's Fantasy Island.
Congratulations to each of you on winning the contest. And welcome to Fantasy Island.
So, what's your fantasy?
The island tailors each fantasy specifically to the guest. Your life is about to change forever. I hope you're ready. How the island does what it does is a mystery.
It brought her back to life.
So, what's your fantasy?
Revenge on a childhood bully. The most popular girl in school was my tormentor. Let's have some fun. Oh my god, that's really her. This is not what I meant!
The island is twisting our fantasies.
We were brought here to be a part of something else.
Once a fantasy begins, you must see it through.
Also known as Blumhouse's Fantasy Island, this is basically both a horror reimagining and prequel to the classic 1977 TV show of the same name. The movie opens with businesswoman Gwen Olson, former police officer Patrick Sullivan, stepbrothers J.D. and Brax Weaver, and teenager Melanie Cole arriving at Fantasy Island, which is a tropical resort where fantasies apparently come true. Upon arrival, island proprietor Mr. Rourke guides the guests to their fantasies. Patrick is enlisted in a war in honor of his late father. The Weavers become honored guests at a mansion rave. Melanie takes revenge on her childhood bully, Sloan Madison, and Gwen accepts her ex-boyfriend Alan Chambers' marriage proposal, which she rejected many years before. Melanie learns that Sloan was kidnapped and brought to Fantasy Island against her will. She ends up saving her from a mass surgeon, and both run away. Meanwhile, Patrick is captured by a military platoon and taken to their commander, Lieutenant Sullivan, whom Patrick recognizes as his father. As night falls, the surgeon attacks both Melanie and Sloan, again before Damon, a private investigator, manages to kill him. Damon then reveals that Rourke offered him to see his deceased daughter again. However, his fantasy turned into a nightmare that trapped him on the island. He also explains that the fantasies are created by spring water under a glowing rock on a cave, and a trio collects some spring water and heads to the resort for help. Gwen then wakes up the next morning to find she has a daughter with Alan and becomes dissatisfied when Rourke explains that the fantasies must be fulfilled so that his own fantasy of being with his deceased wife can continue. Gwen convinces him to give her the fantasy she really wanted, which was to save a neighbor who died in a fire. Unknown to the guests, Fantasy Island begins to turn the fantasies into living nightmares as the Weavers are taken hostage by a drug cartel associated with the mansion's owner, and Gwen is taken to the night she accidentally started a fire that killed her neighbor, Nick Taylor. She finds out that the other guests, except Melanie, were also there and attempts to save Nick, fails, and is rescued by Rourke's assistant, Julia. Elsewhere, Sullivan's soldiers are summoned to rescue the Weavers, and after being shot dead, the cartel reanimates the zombies who attack the soldiers. In the ensuing gunfight, JD is fatally shot, and Sullivan sacrifices himself so Patrick and Brax can escape. Melanie and Sloan are then ambushed by the zombie surgeon until Damon leaps over a cliff with him, saving them at the cost of his own life. The remaining guests then regroup at the resort, but are cornered by Rourke, who reveals that they are in a fantasy in which they are all killed. Realizing that everyone was involved in Nick's death, the guests assume it is Julia's fantasy, as they believe that Julia was Nick's mother. The guests then escape to the dock to be rescued by a plane sent by Damon's associates, but it is shot down. In response, the guests run to the cave to destroy the glowing rock with a grenade Patrick is carrying, and suddenly, Melanie stabs Patrick and takes Sloan hostage, revealing that it is her true fantasy. She orchestrated their arrival to seek revenge on them for Nick's death, with whom she had a date and was convinced was her soulmate. Julia is then revealed to be Rourke's wife and convinces him to help the guests before disappearing. Sloan then remembers the spring water she collected earlier and wishes Melanie to be forever with Nick. As a result, a zombified Nick attacks Melanie and drags her into the water. Before drowning, however, Melanie detonates the grenade, but Patrick sacrifices himself and falls on it to protect the others. And as the fantasy concludes, Gwen, Sloan, and Brax wake up at the resort where Rourke agrees to let them go. While the guests board a plane to leave the now purified Fantasy Island, Brax wishes for JD to come back to life, but Rourke explains Brax must stay on the island for his fantasy to come true. After Gwen, Sloan, and a resurrected JD depart, Rourke asks Brax to become his new assistant. Remembering the nickname JD gave him, Brax chooses to rename himself Tattoo, which initiates the events of the 1977 television series as the movie ends. I've mentioned in earlier episodes how Blumhouse has really dropped the fucking ball when it comes to releases lately. Ma, this movie, The Invisible Man remake, and a couple others that have come out that I can't remember the names of because I've kind of erased them from my memory. They all just basically suck. They're quite slow and boring, and they really just don't have any redeeming value. They're just kind of there, if you get what I mean. They're okay for what they are, I guess, but they're not the powerhouses that Blumhouse used to put out, like, you know, like The Purge and all those other earlier Blumhouse movies. Like I said, I guess it's okay for what it is. It just isn't for me. This had a budget of $7 million and brought in $48.8 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 4.9 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 8%, Letterboxd a 3.3 out of 5, and I give it a 1.5 out of 5. And speaking of Blumhouse, next up we have 2020's The Craft Legacy.
Feather, stiff as a board, light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Basically, sort of, kind of, question mark, a remake, as well as a direct sequel to 1996 classic The Craft. The movie opens with three girls, Frankie, Tabby, and Lourdes, trying to freeze time with magic, but failing as they require a fourth member. Lily Schechner moves into the town with her therapist mother, Helen, to live with Helen's new boyfriend, Adam Harrison, and his three sons, Jacob, Isaiah, and Abe. The girls then befriend Lily after she has her period in class and is mocked by her other classmates, particularly the school bully, Timmy Andrews. They are amazed when she telekinetically pushes Timmy into the lockers, and when Lily responds to them using only her mind, the girls confirm her to be their fourth member and invite her to join their coven, to which she agrees. As a result, they succeed in freezing time. To seek revenge on Timmy, the girls cast a spell on him. The next day, Timmy behaves sensitively, confirming the girls' success. They then continue to experiment with their powers, including levitation. Adam learns of the incident in school and scolds Lily, but Helen defends her, and Lily overhears them arguing and goes outside, where Abe talks to her about his father's authoritarian beliefs. Timmy then hosts a party, inviting the coven, and apologizes to Lily, eventually becoming friends with the coven. When Timmy is at Lily's home for a project with Jacob, he admits to the girls that he had sex with Isaiah, Jacob's older brother, and that he is bisexual. Later, Lily places a love spell on Timmy, using a sweatshirt and the two make out. The next morning during class, the coven is told by their teacher that Timmy allegedly committed suicide the night before. Lily opens up to her friends about her kiss and love spell, and they sever ties with her and bind themselves from magic. Lily suspects Adam to be dangerous and ask her mother for them to move out, but she doesn't agree with her. In hopes to find anything against Adam that she can use, she searches his office only to find her own adoption papers, forcing Helen to admit that to her that Lily is actually her patient's child. After Timmy's funeral, Helen tells Ollie she agrees to move, that she has agreed to move out, and Helen also admits that she knows about her powers of telepathy, telekinesis, and magic. The conversation then sparks Helen to ask Lily to give her powers to Helen, and when Lily suspects her, Helen shapeshifts and turns out to be a disguise by Adam, who, being part of a pagan cult, has been after her powers since the beginning and knocks her unconscious. Lily then awakens in a forest at night with Adam, who confesses that he murdered Timmy and threatens to kill her too. When Timmy contacts Lily's friends and tells him about his murder through a Ouija board, they arrive to save Lily by freezing time, but Adam subdues them quickly. The girls then work together and use their elemental powers to defeat Adam, burning him to death. Later, Lily continues her friendship with the girls, and Helen takes her to an asylum to meet her birth mother, who is revealed to be Nancy Downs from the first film, who is played by Firouza Balk, like she was in the first film, in a nice, very short little cameo. And the movie ends. Like I said, this is pretty much like the first one, since it's pretty much a very soft reboot of it. The whole plot and storyline is pretty familiar if you've seen that first movie, and if you haven't, you should definitely see it. It's not a necessity to watch this, I guess, unless you want to understand the ending. But this is okay, I guess. After having to wait 24 years for a sequel to The Craft, this definitely isn't what it could have been, considering all the time that passed between these two movies. It's like I said, it's just alright for what it is, and it's slightly better than most recent Blumhouse movies. This had a budget of $18 million, but was a flop, as it only brought in $2.3 million at the box office. Sorry, I dropped my phone. IMDb gave this a 4.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes at 47%, Letterboxd once again a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 2.1 out of 5. Next up is 2002's Queen of the Damned. Based very loosely, and I use that term generously, on the late, great Anne Rice's 1988 novel of the same name. The movie opens with the vampire Lestat awakening from decades of slumber by the sounds of a hard rock band and proceeds to take over as their lead singer. Achieving international success, Lestat, having revealed the existence of vampires, taunts the others of his kind during an interview for promoting his first and only live concert. Jesse Reeves, a researcher for the paranormal studies group Talamasca, is intrigued by Lestat's lyrics after hearing one of his songs play on TV and tells the rest of the group her theory that he really is a vampire. Her mentor, David Talbot, takes her aside and tells her they know what he is and that a vampire called Marius made him. David also shows her Lestat's journal that he recovered and gives it to Jesse for her to read on the condition that she promises not to go back to the Admiral's Arms. In the journal, Lestat recalls how he was turned into a vampire by Marius and how he awoke Akasha, the first vampire, with his music. Unsatisfied with what she has read, Jesse tracks Lestat down to a London vampire club called the Admiral's Arms, where he saves her from three vampires and confronts her about Marius. In Los Angeles, Lestat is visited by Marius, who warns him that the other vampires will not tolerate his flamboyant public profile. And Marius also reveals that Lestat's new music has awakened Akasha and begs him to cancel his concert, which he refuses. Meanwhile, Akasha, who is searching for Lestat, arrives at the Admiral's Arms, and after a vampire reveals that they're planning to kill Lestat at his concert, Akasha tortures the club and kills all the vampires inside. Jesse then arrives at Los Angeles and gives Lestat his journal back. She then asks him to show her what being a vampire is like, and Lestat scoffs at the idea, but Jesse convinces him to spend his last moments before the concert with her. The two spend some time together, and Jesse later asks Lestat to turn her, telling him she wants to be with him and that she wants to know everything he does. Lestat then angrily refuses and shows her what it's like for a vampire to feed aggressively on a human. He comes back to her asking her if this is truly what she wants, and she recoils in fear from him, and he laughs at her agreeing and then leaves. While performing at his concert in Death Valley, a group of vampires attack Lestat. With Marius' help, they both fend off most of the vampires until Akasha bursts through the stage and takes Lestat with her. Akasha brings Lestat to her new home, where the two vampires fuck, and during which time Lestat becomes spellbound by Akasha and is forced to obey her, and Akasha proclaims Lestat her new king. After the concert, Jesse is taken to the home of her aunt, Merit, who later reveals herself to be one of the ancient vampires. Knowing Akasha's plan to take over the world, the ancient vampires discuss their plans to destroy the queen by drinking from her and draining her of her blood. However, they believe that whoever drinks the queen's last drop will not survive. Empowered by Akasha's blood, Lestat and the queen confront the ancient vampires, and when they refuse to join her, Akasha then commands Lestat to kill Jesse, as the queen sees her both as an enemy due to being Merit's descendant and as food, with Akasha making an example out of her for those who dare disobey her command. Lestat obeys, but after drinking Jesse's blood, comes to his senses and is released from Akasha's power. He angrily requests for his crown, and Akasha openly gives him her arm to feed on, and Lestat then turns on her and begins to drain Akasha's blood. With the help of the ancients, Akasha's power diminishes, and Merit is the last to drink Akasha's blood, killing Akasha. Lestat then goes to Jesse, and cradling her in his arms, gives her his blood as Merit turns into a marble statue and quote-unquote sleeps, becoming the new Queen of the Damned. Lestat and Jesse, who is now a vampire, visit David and return Lestat's journal. When asked by David what it's like, Jesse offers to turn him into a vampire, to which he replies he's too old for immortality. Jesse then bids David goodbye and goes to embrace him. David shows fear and rejects the embrace, and sensing his hesitation, Jesse looks hurt but nods in understanding, and she then leaves with Lestat. A few moments later, David is then greeted by Marius. And as the film closes, we see Lestat and Jesse walking hand in hand among mortals into the night. Out of all the movies that have been adaptations of Anne Rice's books, this is quite rightfully looked at as the worst out of all of them. It really is a bad fucking movie. It's quite hokey. The acting is kind of iffy by most people involved with it. And the effects aren't horrible, but they are still pretty lame. And it's pretty much widely agreed that the soundtrack to this, which features a lot of nu metal bands, is actually a lot better than this movie. And I have to agree with that. If you're going to have anything to do with this movie, listen to the soundtrack instead of actually watching it. You'll be much more pleased with the soundtrack than the actual movie. It was also, unfortunately, Leah's last movie before she was killed in a plane crash. This had a budget of $35 million and brought in $45.5 million at the box office. IMDb gives this a 5.2 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 17%, Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 1 out of 5. Actually, I'll give it a 1.3 out of 5 just on the basis of the soundtrack. And that brings us to the final film of the episode, and that is the fucking god-awful 2003 House of the Dead.
It was a nightmare. It all started a few days ago.
Where do you hide? When you're everywhere.
Everywhere.
What do you do when there's no way out?
No.
How do you kill?
Kill.
What's already dead?
Dead.
Any way you...
Like I said, I'm dead this week. It all started a few days ago.
Doesn't this bother any of you? We're on the island where the party of the year is supposed to be happening, but it's completely deserted.
Well, they sure as hell did not go to 7-Eleven to get more booze.
Can't hear anything.
Neither do I. Run! Run! There must be some kind of scientific explanation for this.
It's not human. It's like it's been mutated.
So, what now?
We send them back to hell.
Is that you, Matt?
Based on the classic Sega video game series or franchise of the same name, after booking a boat trip to attend a rave on an island located off the coast of Seattle named Isla del Muerte, or Island of the Dead, two college students, Simon and Greg, meet up with three girls, Alicia, Karma, and Greg's girlfriend, Cynthia. When the five arrive at the dock, they find that they are late, and that the boat that is supposed to take them to Isla del Muerte has already left. A boat captain named Victor Kirk and his first mate, Salish, then offer them a ride on their boat. Arriving at the island, they find that the rave site has been messed up and deserted. Alicia, Karma, and Simon leave the site to go find anybody around, while Cynthia and Greg stay behind. As Greg and Cynthia are about to make out in a tent, the former leaves... Greg leaves to go take a piss. Alone in tent, Cynthia is killed by a group of zombies. Meanwhile, Alicia, Karma, and Simon find a derelict house, and as they attempt to investigate the place, they discover Alicia's ex-boyfriend Rudy, Liberty, and Hugh, who inform them of a zombie attack during the rave. The six then leave the house to fetch Greg and Cynthia. Meanwhile, the zombies kill Salish while he is alone in the forest. Alicia, Rudy, Karma, Simon, Liberty, and Hugh then return to the rave site and find Greg. A zombified Cynthia comes out from behind a tree and kills Hugh, but is killed when Casper, a Coast Guard officer who was tracking Kirk, arrives and shoots her. They form a plan to return to Kirk's boat and leave the island, and when they return to the beach, they find that zombies are on Kirk's boat. Casper and Greg leave the group to go find help, but Greg is killed in the forest. Kirk then reveals the island's history. It was home to a Spanish Catholic priest named Castillo Sermano, who was banished from Spain in the 15th century for his dark experiments, which the Catholic Church forbade. Castillo then murdered the crew of St. Cristobal, the ship that was taking him to the island, and enslaved the island's natives, and murdered anyone who visited the place. He then created the immortality serum, which he injected himself with, allowing him to live forever and return dead souls to life and support his cause. Kirk then leads the group to a spot in the forest where he has hidden a box full of guns and weaponry. Once everyone is armed, they decide to head back to the house, only to find the courtyard filled with zombies. Liberty and Casper are killed in the ensuing fight, and Alicia, Rudy, Kirk, Karma, and Simon manage to take shelter inside the house. When Kirk is alone, he hears Salish whistling outside. He goes outside and sees Salish as a zombie. Kirk then sacrifices himself by killing Salish and a bunch of zombies with a stick of dynamite, but the explosion also blows up the entrance to the house. The remaining four lock themselves in a lab inside the house, but the zombies break in. Karma finds a hatch in the floor, which she, Alicia, and Rudy use to escape. Simon then sacrifices himself to kill the zombies by shooting a barrel of gunpowder, blowing up the house and the zombies. Alicia, Rudy, and Karma then find themselves in tunnels. They make their way through the tunnels, but Karma is killed by zombies as she attempts to hold them off, as Rudy and Alicia flee like pussies. Alicia and Rudy are then aided out of the tunnels by a mysterious man wearing Greg's face as a mask. The man is revealed to be Castillo Sermano, who then orders a horde of zombies to restrain Alicia and Rudy in an attempt to kill them and use their flesh for his own purposes. Alicia and Rudy escape Castillo, blowing the tunnels up in the process, but Castillo manages to survive the blast, and Alicia gets into a sword fight with him. Castillo then stabs her in the heart, and Rudy manages to decapitate him soon after. However, the still-alive, headless body of Castillo begins to strangle Rudy. Alicia, who is barely alive, somehow gets up and crushes the head under her foot, which finally kills Castillo. Although Alicia seemingly dies, she and Rudy are rescued by a team of agents, and the agents ask for Rudy's name, to which he responds with Rudolph Kurian, which implies that this film is a prequel to the House of the Dead arcade game. And the movie ends with revealing that Rudy gave Alicia the immortality serum, and the two survivors return home. Directed by German director Uwe Boll, who is quite rightfully recognized as one of the worst fucking directors in modern times, this movie is definitely not worth your time. It's stupid. It's horribly acted. The plot doesn't make much sense. The characters all act horribly fucking stupid. And they even try to make some scenes look like the video game. Once all the people all the characters in the movie are armed with guns. They even have like a kill count up in the right side of the screen. It's all just done very stupidly. The effects are terrible as well, and except for one or two, most of the zombie effects and makeup are shit as well. This had a budget of $12 million, but somehow brought in $13.8 million at the box office. IMDb gave this a 2.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 3%. Letterboxd, somehow, for some fucking reason, a 3.1 out of 5, and I give it a big fat 0 out of 5. And that just about wraps it up for this episode. As always, you can reach out to me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.